Welcome back to the Harden Up Podcast, your show for everything training and adventure related. You can check out our training courses at optempotraining.com or on social media at optempotraining. This episode is proudly supported by Loa Boots. The Optempo team has been using Loas for over 5 years for police patrol, SWAT operations, and military training. For almost 100 years, Loa Outdoor and Tactical Boots have been acclaimed for their extraordinary high levels of fit, quality, and innovation. They've continued this tradition with the newly released Zephyr Mark II GTX Mid, with features specific to tactical work. Find out more at loaboots.com or follow them on social media at loa.professional. On today's show, I'll be speaking with a Marine Corps combat veteran and former drill instructor, now turned fitness industry professional. Please enjoy this conversation with Jason Clark. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Harden Up Podcast. My guest today is Jason Clark, a United States Marine Corps veteran who served as a combat engineer, Marine Corps martial arts instructor, primary marksmanship instructor, and drill instructor. After his combat deployments and time in the Corps, Jason went on to work in the fitness industry at private gyms and then as a strength and conditioning director for the Marine Corps HIIT program. He also served on the advisory board for human performance at Headquarters Marine Corps. Jason then accepted the role of director of training and education at BeaverFit USA, a veteran-owned and operated organization that is the largest supplier of fitness equipment to the U.S. Armed Forces. Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Great pleasure to have you, another Marine Corps veteran on the show, hearing about what you're doing, and just to hear more about what BeaverFit is doing as well. So kind of just start out with how you got into the fitness space in general. And obviously, I know Marine Corps has a lot of emphasis on fitness, but how did you kind of get into this journey?
Yeah, you know, I would say that it just started with some self-discovery at a very young age. You know, I was an overweight kid. Even though I played a lot of sports year round, I struggled with what I would say is even understanding nutrition and how it all worked together. So I fixed that through fitness. Really what I would say is I went to a beyond progressive overload. I just went into overload mode and, you know, did a lot of fitness things. And that transcended itself through the Marine Corps and really just turned into be more just purely lifestyle than it did anything else. And now it's just been part of me for so long that I don't know if I would know what to do without it per se.
Yeah, man. So was it a struggle to get through the initial phase of Marine Corps enlistment? Because I know there's it may have changed since the time I was in, but there was a pre boot camp PFT, you had to, like a mini PFT you had to pass just to go to ship, right? Was that a struggle for you?
Yeah, you know, they still call it the IST. Okay. So you run it with the recruiter. As long as you're kind of green lighted, or what I would say is a shaky yellow light, they will ship you. And then you got to run it again once you aboard either Paris Island or San Diego to start recruit training. Yeah, it was a struggle because it was just new, you know, playing lots of soccer. But now it's this idea of run a mile and a half hard, you know, pull ups. Not something I was used to. So I had to get used to it in its own way. So definitely was a struggle, but I didn't take it as a defeating moment as much as just truly recognizing, okay, I've got to get better at this.
Yeah, yeah. Did you have any family background in the military, anybody that was kind of like drawn you into that kind of direction?
Yeah, you know, my grandfather will always be my hero. He was a World War II generation, and definitely for him, you know, he was a big mentor of mine, but just always someone who I looked at life that, you know, lied about their age to join a military to go fight a world war, that lived through a Great Depression, that came back and led a family with grace and empathy, and ran a construction company, all to say, I believe that there was something about his time in service that he always represented as well. And even though it wasn't a big talking point,
yeah,
it was just how he represented himself when he dealt with other people that I was always attracted to.
Yeah, man. Models like that are just invaluable. If I just, for people that grew up and didn't have somebody quite like that or be able to kind of, you know, be a physical representation of that generation, which I agree is the greatest generation. So, you know, a little bit off of your inspiration is, do you ever think we're going to get back to a time like that, man? I mean, you speak of that, and guys like that are few and far between these days, in my opinion. What do you think? You're out there interacting with military personnel, civilians. What is your pulse on that, just since we're talking about it?
Yeah. I believe that ship has sailed for us to ever get back to a moment like that. And then maybe that's not necessarily a bad thing. What I would say is we have to constantly be, I think, students of the of where we are in time and what does it mean and what does it represent? You know, I will tell you that I have part of me that is sour to that concept. My time as a Marine Corps drill instructor, the Vietnam era would always come visit recruit training. And they would always tell me as a drill instructor how my recruits were weak and how they weren't as strong as they were. We don't beat them. We don't do all these things to them. Right. And it would go into all these things about the kids, right? Like the kids just can't, they aren't this, they aren't that. And, you know, eventually after a few visits and hearing that, you know, I had to remind them like, hey, times change, but the mission has remained the same.
Yeah.
And I've never seen a young kid at 10, 11, 12 years old be able to push the money to buy their own Xbox or iPad or these other things that we're talking about that cause conflict. So I'm not putting it all on the kid that's the problem. I'm putting it on us over what we've allowed them to grow up being. Yeah. And so to answer your question, yes, I think the ship has sailed. However, I think society is also showing us that there's somewhat of a pull to get back to this kind of more resilient personification of the human and people chasing longevity. And it all will come back to pretty much what is your level of fitness mentally and physically and emotionally? Yeah. That's going to probably dictate that.
It's a great kind of perspective, man. I mean, I think change is good. I know some people don't embrace it as much, but I think if it can be done in the right way, we can still maintain values along the way. I think it's okay to change and to progress. Right. But when we start losing values, I think that's where people start having some heartburn on that. But thank you for that perspective. And I wanted to kind of touch on, cause you mentioned obviously your time in the Marine Corps drill instructor. So we're just going to jump right to that. I think you're our first drone instructor on the show over the 3 years we've been doing this. So we just got to ask, cause you know, nice. Guys are curious about it. So talk to me about, you know, when you're in MOSX, you know, I was an 03, guys are 20, this, mm-hmm. whatever MOS, what is the process like to become a drone instructor? And just, can you talk about what that looks like?
Yeah. You know, for me, it was pretty simple. I came in with two goals. One was to be a drone instructor. The other was to be the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. The first one happened. The second one, we had a kind of a tattoo policy that got involved while I was there, and I didn't exactly fit in anymore in that realm. So I realized number two was probably gone. But, you know, the process of being a drone instructor has changed over time. It used to be a complete volunteer duty, and that's no longer the case. Some are voluntold. From there, you know, they will receive orders to drone instructor school, which is 3 months long. Just like recruit training, it is more demanding than recruit training. Physically and mentally, and really because you are a Marine and you have a level of maturity, to me, the greatest challenge of drone instructor school is to realize they own your time again. And you don't have the exactly, I'm done at 1700 and it's my time. And a lot of Marines struggle with that. You know, again, for me, I'm not different than many others that went down there before me. Drone instructor at the moment of time. You know, you got to do it, you know, kind of like recruit training. Got it. I'll be here. You can't stop time. We'll graduate. We'll go on to do what we're here to do.
Did you find that most of the guys in you, at least in your class, were there because they wanted to be there voluntarily?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. My class was still all volunteer. Voluntold was beginning when I left the depot in 09. Yeah. And there was some, you know, kind of some rumblings about it. And now there's Hearst teams, just like there used to be for recruiting, that would screen recruiters and put them on recruiting duty. That is the same for drill instructor duty. Now they can screen you. And if you're good to go, they can assign you orders to the depot.
That, I mean, it seems that you would want people that are motivated and want to be there, especially in that billet where you're so impactful on people coming into the Marine Corps and what they're going to become on the other side of recruit training.
Yeah. You know, if you ask Jason Clark's opinion, I do not believe it is a voluntold duty ever. And simply for the level of commitment that it will take from you professionally as a Marine, but also personally, and the sacrifices you're going to have to make with your family. Yeah. You know, the age old kind of running gimmick down there was that it's worse than a deployment because you're here, but you're not here. Unfortunately, that's where the divorces come in and all the horror stories of the depot, because it is demanding.
Right.
It is 7 days a week. You know, it is 3 months at a time. And you know, the first 4 weeks of those cycles are typically for every drill instructor are, you know, on deck at 0330. And, you know, you probably get home if it's not your duty night, probably somewhere around, you know, 2100 at night, 2130. Wow. Just to repeat it the next day.
Yeah. So beyond the family constraints and the time and stuff, what did you find was your biggest challenge going to the drill instructor role? Just because it wraps really into the physical aspect, being a trainer, instructor. What was that hardest piece stepping into that role?
That it's not your standard. It's the Marine Corps standard. And being a drill instructor was not challenging me because I had a high level of care. And I really believed we were also at war. I believed in what we did and still to this day believe in it to the fullest, that it's what separates the Marine Corps is its beginning. And my challenge was accepting what was the standard at times and those that would make it through, knowing you were going to send somebody and there was probably a very high chance, irregardless of MOS, they will find themselves overseas.
Yeah.
So that was the challenging what piece that is, because once you go to your standard, which is not fair to them either, and I know that now, you can get a little wild with your ways to find that standard.
Yeah. What a level of responsibility knowing that the guys are going to get deployed. You know what I mean? Versus the time I went in, it was fairly peacetime. Somalia, things like that were happening, but it wasn't like this is happening now and more like you're going to get deployed. So what a responsibility, man. Did you feel like you had all the tools you needed to be a DI on, you know, day one versus you picked up things along the way? What was your experience with that?
No, you have no clue what you think you do. I mean, cause I was pretty confident in myself, right? Like, I mean, I love the Marine Corps. I had a pretty good track record up until that point of doing a lot of things and being in a lot of places and excelling in all those areas and, excelled in drill instructor school. Day one on deck in front of recruits, you realize how much you don't know, right? Like, okay, so where do I go? Where do I move? Where do I say? What do I do? You know, so yes, I mean, you have the tools as long as you have the tools of being effective and, you know, and taking the initiative, the rest will make its way out. You'll learn all the little cheat codes and all the little pieces that, you know, make that well-oiled machine work together. And you learn those over time.
You're bringing back memories of me just talking about that. I mean, I remember, I don't know if it's the same in every cycle, but you know, you had your senior, you had your heavy, and then somewhere you had like some mid-level guys and then like a brand new guy. Like I swear, I think it was his first cycle because there would be dumb things that recruits would do. And I swear he'd put his hat down to kind of hide a smile or take his hat off and do something. And I just remember he was the one that couldn't keep a straight face for a time. And then he got like meaner and better at what he was doing. So it was just fun to see. So just great, great memories you're pulling. So along the way, man, did you have any memorable trainers or anybody that was impactful to you instructor wise, even before your time in the Marine Corps, anything that you can kind of think of that maybe played a role when you were a DI later on?
Seeing as I will tell you, and this is kind of, I have a whiteboard memory, you know, as a sophomore in high school, I got to go to Paris Island on like boot camp with JROTC. And my drill instructor for that mini boot camp, can still give you his name to this day, Sergeant Mercado. And when I got there and saw this image of this person, it stuck with me forever. Physically fit, he was sharp. He was emotionally just well glued. And that was my first taste that I realized like that I could take him and I could move him to my mirror. And that's what I wanted to be right there. So that was without a doubt the very first most impactful person that carried with me, I would say, for quite a while to, you know, and obviously all these years later, we're probably at 27 years later. I can still tell you his name.
And that's pretty memorable for all the people out there that are listening that are military. That just shows you how impactful drone instructors in any branch are. When you can remember their names 20, 25 years later, that's impactful, man. And I think that's something to be taken seriously, you know, and not that you didn't do that, but I just, for me as an outsider listening to your story, that's such a huge, you know, just weight that you got to go, man, these guys are going to remember you.
It is. And, you know, I was fortunate enough to have a senior drill instructor that had, I would say, different level of care than most. Week three in boot camp, when I had a question about this whole fitness thing, he listened and answered my question, didn't tell me to go away. And then as I'm about to graduate DI school, now, mind you, we opened this with that I struggled to pass the initial strength test. As we're about to graduate drill and shutter school, I am the Ironman of drill and shutter school, the highest PFT score. And all the instructors at DI school at this point in time, you know, there's a lot of gimmicks now, right? Like they just kind of play with you a little bit. And we had a room inspection in our barracks, one of the final ones. And they're going through my uniforms and, you know, they had a lot of things to say to me. The war was young. I came back with a few different ribbons that, you know, raised eyebrows because it was so new. And, you know, so they're kind of mocking me with like the, you know, are you chesty puller? And, you know, and all of a sudden they dove it and they said, you know, I bet your senior drill instructor would be real proud of you. And, you know, I was like, you know, yes, Colonel Sergeant. And they said, who was your senior drill instructor? And when I gave him my senior drill instructor's name, which it was Staff Sergeant Rowe, Daryl Rowe, they parted like a Red Sea. And there was my senior drill instructor for when I was a recruit. And he walked into my room as I'm graduating DI school to hand me his Iron Man t-shirt from when he was the Iron Man of drill instructor school. You know, all to say, I never did not have a high level of respect and care for that job because of what he did for me. And really, to this day, the tone he set for my life, from who he was, is just simply a human being.
Wow, man, what a moment. I know they planned it, they had it all ready to go, but man, how cool. Because you know those moments in the Marine Corps happen here and there when guys are able to put something like that together. That must have been a pretty amazing moment, man.
Yeah, you know, I think because of being on the other side of it for so long and I can look back upon it, you know, there are moments in combat that are surreal and impactful, good, bad, and indifferent. You know, I'm a big proponent of moving beyond the Marine Corps moments though, right? And just the moments of humanity. Yeah. 'Cause when the uniform's all done, that's what we need. Sure. Is the moments of humanity. And he was just that, you know, in every which way. We were nowhere near alike. You know, I'm a 5'9" white guy. He's about a 6'6" black guy. You know, just complete as different as you could be, but he truly was just a great human. Yeah. who cared.
Yeah. Wow. That's very cool, man. Well, talking about, you know, the drill instructor experience, which I really appreciate you kind of going into that, was I know you did some other roles in the Marine Corps, combat engineer, Marine Corps martial arts program. So during my time, that was right when it was transitioning. I remember in like 2002, it was transitioning from the old line training to the MCMAP program, right? And I think that's about the time that you went to the instructor school. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was. I was, you know, I was there in on staff in 2005, pretty much for the most of the year, 2005. So again, it was still a very, very brand new program. Yeah.
So looking at that time, I want to say the physical stuff started changing, at least the training side, maybe not the PFTs, but the training side was changing right around that time as well. So you can talk a little bit about the legacy military physical training program and what we saw in like the, maybe the 80s and 90s versus now.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, what a transition. At the same time, there's still a lack of transition and a need for it. You know, we could go down each of the services because they are actually kind of taking different avenues and lanes to this, which is interesting to observe because you get some sort of, you know, data feedback on that to kind of look at, like, are they doing it right? Are they doing it wrong? You know, bring up the Marine Corps Martial Arts Program, though, is a great kind of segue because it was known as probably one of the best hazes the Marine Corps had to offer. And, you know, when I went to that schoolhouse for 8 weeks coming off of, you know, a year plus pump, you know, in theater, I wasn't in shape for here we go on X amount of mile run to X amount of times O courses to X amount of, you know, OC spray. Because we can, you know, low crawl here because you can. And, you know, I those are what we had to get over, though, was because there was a level of resiliency and a level of entry level mental and physical toughness that could bear that type of thought process and training being indoctrinated, you know, pretty much right away. And as time has gone on, what we're realizing is that entry-level baseline is really what constantly moves. It's not the end state, because the end state we can get to, and really, as we see in athletics, we can move beyond those that came before us in this idea of performance. But the entry-level is what we have to pay homage to and respect to, that, hey, times have changed. The mission remains the same. Possibly our tactics and the way we go about this need to look and feel different now. We are not going to get away with just simply having kids show up and run 3 miles. We may break quite a few. A prime example of this is, just because of my current role, I recently had a conversation with some folks on Paris Island, and they picked up an entire company this year. And in that company, they had a 67% fail rate on the initial strength tests between males and females combined. 67% failed. When they got to the final PFT, physical fitness test, they had still had over a 30% fail rate. Unheard of on the depots, right? Unheard of. Like, in fact, in my time, 4 years there, I never had a kid fail a final PFT. So it's very easier for us to go to the kid, right? There's the problem, the kid. The kid's not strong enough. And that's obviously pretty true. So how do we change that and move away from what we've done to realize that we really need to look at building a foundation, but we really need to look at what we necessarily didn't have to do before is build scaffolding that goes taller, because we probably need to support them for a longer journey now than what we used to have to do. Our entry-level program was okay. People got it. They went on and everything was fine. That's just not the case now. We really need to look at, hey, you know, just because we can do something doesn't mean we should do something. Just because it was done to us doesn't mean it's okay to do it to the next generation that comes after us. And there is where we're having a lot more methodical looks at physical fitness in general. We're bringing in subject matter experts, those with degrees and, you know, 4-year degrees and even PhDs into the space to say, okay, how should we train? How should it look? What I think we're in a crossroads of is, how do we implement civilian SMEs, but we still empower leaders to lead? And that is the crossroads that I sit in right now often, is that filling that gap and building a bridge between the two.
Yeah, that's a lot to unpack there, but I do want to hit something that you mentioned, is the entry level fitness. Can you kind of expand on that? When you say that, are you referring to the fitness I show up to boot camp, or do you mean the way we initially roll fitness out to these guys on day one? What do you mean by the entry level?
Yeah. So what I mean by that is the baseline level of fitness of the individual when they show up. So for instance, like, you know, there used to be never a question about the schedule of boot camp. You're going to be on your feet a lot. You're going to move for roughly 16 hours a day with probably about a combined, hopefully maybe an hour, hour and a half of sitting. Your feet were not really an issue. Now feet are an issue because guess what? So much of a sedentary lifestyle. So what I mean by that is the baseline or the starting point of the individual when they get there has shifted and it has changed.
Oh, gotcha. So that obviously would need to be reflective of the first, say, 4 weeks of boot camp on the physical side. Going off what you're saying, right?
You would think. Yeah. You would think. Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't think we're answering that as best we could. And this is the easiest way I say that on why I don't believe so. The Army has done some good things. And in fact, on Fort Jackson right now, their boot camp looks a little bit different. Strength and conditioning, barbells, kettlebells, med balls type idea are now brought in at an entry level, which isn't important that they're under load. It's important that they're getting used to movement patterns, which is what all of this is built for. But when I go to Paris Island, because I still live near it, and when I ride onto that installation, it looks no different than when I went through recruit training. So the tools and the resources are still exactly the same that we had 24, 25 years ago. How is that exactly, you know, going to work out for us?
So can you kind of help me steer this in the right direction? So legacy training, what I was used to was kind of a circuit-based training from my memory of, you know, we're running 2-3 miles a day. We're doing these circuit exercises. They were trying to do some kind of a complex that way. What was the goal, do you think, at that point versus what you're seeing now?
Yeah, you know, if you broke it down from a scientific approach, really, back in the day, we built big aerobic engines. That we built individuals that could just go for a really long time. And we really didn't have a way to necessarily build strength outside of kind of some ideas of, you know, going on rucks or marches and circuit style training, but it's really, that's not strength. Yeah. And what we realized over time, though, is that the aerobic capacity or the big motor, we still need it. But we don't need it as much as what we thought we needed it. And we don't need to train it as much as we thought we needed to train it as well. And there's where science comes in and research comes in to realize that the true health of longevity and performance is why the whole program is called strength and conditioning. We need the people to get stronger. We need to load them up with barbells and kettlebells and other resources to truly develop the strength side of things, because we're really good at aerobic exercise. We're really good at it. Like you already said, right? Like anybody in the U.S. military can run. Even if they're a bad runner, they run well above average. Yeah. Why? Because and here's the other side of it. And this is just the factual side. The amount of extra knowledge needed to lead training like that is very minimal, right? It take you to have a degree to say face to the right for a run. It doesn't take a 4-year degree to figure out, let's just do push-ups. If I do push-ups until people fail, probably not going to be either. Do another push-up. But now I put a barbell in somebody's hands. You know, now I've got kettlebells swinging through the area. There is a different level of competence and confidence needed in the unit leader. That is part of where I think the legacy side is so hard to let go of, because the resources needed were minimal. The extra knowledge was minimal. We could empower young kids to lead from a very young age. Hey, you get in front, lead PT today. No problem. I'm just, you know, I can do the daily 16, go for a run. Got it. So there's a lot there that we are discovering right now. And I'll say this, because I also have a very soft spot for this, because I get to hear it, right? When I hear people, and I'm at schoolhouses where this stuff is taught in the U.S. military, I always tell them, like, hey, how are you going to go back and get that sergeant major or that master guns or that colonel or that general to believe that this is the way? And somebody always does me right and says exactly what I know they're going to say, which is, you've been doing it wrong. Here is the right way to do it. And I always tell them, they weren't doing it wrong. They were doing with what they had, and they were effective with what they had. We've learned that we need more strength training. We've learned that we need more resources to have strength training. That's why we train this way now. Not because it was wrong. It was not wrong. Yeah. It was exactly right.
So based
right
on
the
operational
time.
Needs of what's currently going on, since you've got a pulse on that, why do these individuals need more strength versus just aerobic engines?
You know, there's people way smarter than me that give you better answers. I'm going to give you my real answer, because we're lazy. We don't do hard things. We don't do tough things. We don't go outside and play sport on a regular basis. We've allowed most of that by the wayside. And to be fair, because of that, the internal fire from the majority of human beings, whether they join the U.S. military or not, does not exist on this pathway of let me be the best. And that, I'm going to give you that as the answer. There is much better scientific answers to it, especially when it comes to musculoskeletal injuries. When it comes to what does strength training truly mean in the area of resiliency or making a harder human, all great. But to me, it comes down to simply the, you know, what don't we have anymore that we need to now add in to fix?
And you touched on a good point there, the injury side. I just remember guys getting injured coming up, and it wasn't, of course, they didn't want them to get injured, but it wasn't seen as such a detriment, right? Just because there was such an influx of good people, quality candidates, recruits. How has that changed today where an injury now, man, I mean, with the number of good quality people you have, you don't want people to get injured. You've invested time, money, resources, all that. So what are your thoughts on that injury kind of perspective?
Yeah, you know, I also don't think just injuries happen at the plethora they happen today. You know, the numbers have shifted, obviously, right? There are more injuries today than there were in previous. Injuries have always existed, but they're just a little more common now. However, what I do think is good about that is we're factoring a human factor into this, which is we don't want people hurt simply because they're people. And if there's ways to avoid injury, we can never prevent it. We can mitigate it. We can make better decisions to give us a better chance not to get hurt. Then let's do that. But yes, is it also in response to, you know, it's recruiting numbers are down, retention numbers are down. We need to keep people healthy. Absolutely. But, you know, it's very interesting is again, I get to give my opinion to a few different people about this. You know, I remember this year at the International Science Committee in London when we were presenting and, you know, I had a picture of an airplane and, you know, I said, if we put the human next to it and said that your budget is responsible for fixing the human, your budget is responsible for paying them until they get well and can fly again. I imagine it would look different than it naturally does right now, because there's really no level of ownership or responsibility to when we hurt people, especially done if it's just in a training environment and it happens. You know, they move on to medical and there's other programs that can help them along the way, but the unit is not responsible for it. And I'm not saying they mean it to do it that way, but they are, without a doubt, if we treated it like we did other things like aircraft and vehicles, I think it would look a little different.
Yeah. Well, you kind of touched on, you know, talking about the legacy kind of training, you touched on the current training, but what is just the overall picture of what you're seeing out there currently in military physical training, just across the board, at least what footprint you've seen out there? What does that look like now? I know we already talked about legacy. What's the current one look? So guys and gals out there can listen and go, hey, this is what is happening now.
Yeah. You know, again, this is where the services get a little bit unique. You know, when you look at the Army right now, entry-level training involves true strength and conditioning with strength and conditioning coaches, with cognitive coaches, with sports psychologists. I mean, it's full on in the U.S. Army right now, where they are looking to, from the very beginning, put them in a foundational, all the knowledge and the resources to be successful in this world of fitness and strength and conditioning. Go to the U.S. Air Corps, like it's looked for here. Exercises, circuit style training, a lot of running, obstacle courses along the way, you know, Air Force, Navy, very similar as well. Navy is probably the most interesting, as they have been vocal on adopting more of a model of wellness than they have fitness long term. So, you know, all to say, it does look different in some. But there's still just a moment of discovery where everybody's trying to figure out that right path and what is the right way to do it and the most effective way to do it. So, you know, and the other thing is that I'll say to that is I will never, you know, so everybody truly understands the landscape. Boot camp is the hardest thing inside the Department of Defense to make a change to, because it is one of the points that Congress has and the Senate has. Changes into this big eyes on concept, it does not happen even if it makes the most sense. It takes a lot of time and a lot of efforts. You know, even though as the Marine Corps, I say boot camp looks the same, we have seen some other initiatives from the Marine Corps right now that are looking different. You know, within even the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps doing some tours and looking at new facilities like on Camp Lejeune and saying, hey, this is the future of the Marine Corps. You know, him bringing up the concept of building gyms inside the barracks, you know, all these kind of future designs. So, yes, currently doesn't look a lot different except for the U.S. Army. However, there is a lot of
So how does that happen between branches where you get these big, huge discrepancies. Because if I'm, you know, you can kind of get into like, you know, director of physical programming, but how do I do it if I'm over here on the Marine Corps side and this guy's on the Army side and they're developing something that looks pretty good? How do we get these different things that we're looking at, you're describing?
Yeah, you know, it's tough because the Marine Corps honestly has great programs too, right? Like you could look at School of Infantry East and what they have stood up over there is phenomenal of a program within strength and conditioning. You know, Second MLG on Camp Lejeune has its own human performance program. The Semper Fit team from the headquarters level down is trying to drive these big initiatives, but at entry level, they don't look the same. And everybody's saying, now, why is that? You know, the same could be at MARSOC. It all comes down to leadership and how they view us getting to the objective in the most clear manner. And then, unfortunately, it involves funding, and it involves a lot of funding change over time.
Wow. Okay. So that makes a lot of sense as why we can see those differences in those, you know, different programs, different units. Well, what did it look like going from, you know, being a Marine, a DI, and having a certain touch point on fitness going to, you know, a advisory board for human performance? How did that look like? Headquarters Marine Corps? I mean, that seems like big picture, you know, 10,000 foot view, can make changes. What was that transition like, and what did you do there?
Yeah, you're more of a recommendation than you are a change factor, you know, but it is truly bringing in some of the brightest minds, you know, and I would say forward thinkers into the space to try to consolidate all those good idea fairies, really, right? Because we're all full of them. What is actually tangible? What is actually actionable? And, you know, how could we do it somewhere? How could we? And if you think about it, the Marine Corps took a pretty big stab at it, at itself, with, you know, standing up a HIIT program. You know, even though it's not HIIT, what most people think, high intensity interval training, it was the idea of high intensity tactical training. You know, the brand name might have been a little off for it to really hit its mark, but so be it. You know, but when we're in those boards and all those things are standing up, really, it's trying to just consolidate everybody's independent location ideas, what everybody's doing at their one spot that's working, bring them into a collective. Can we actually write POIs on this? Can we actually write this into lesson plans that can be, you know, carried out at, you know, is great concept. However, it does authority over time. It still has to have its decisions that come out of those boards convened to a higher level, and it still has to be approved and adopted within POIs or and whatnot.
Yeah. Did you find that overall in all the different branches that you've kind of worked amongst that it's hard to bring civilian SMEs in to kind of advise, or are most of the branches open to it and to get more, you know, qualified expertise input?
Yeah, you know, that is a long convo if I take it to where I want to go with it. I love the civilian counterparts being involved with it because they don't have other ancillary duties that pull them away from their focus of being an SME in that area. And that is fantastic. You know, in my time, I never saw major conflict between uniform and civilians, you know, and I was a civilian. So, you know, I never saw the conflict. However, as the programs grow, that means there's more of that. And that means that, you know, backgrounds are different. That means that, you know, a lot of folks that come to work for the military have no clue about the military or the lifestyle involved with it. You know, and that's where conflict can arise a little bit, is when, as a civilian, you don't pay the respect to understand what you're walking into and pay the respect to certain cultural ideologies that will happen no matter what your opinion of if they are okay or not. And to remember that you were hired to advise, you're not a policy creator, often in these roles. So have conversations that lead to good advice when you see things, don't pull the red flag up over that's wrong or that's not right, because that's when it gets conflictual, when they say, well, cool, we've been doing it for 200 years and we're going to keep doing it. And it gets kind of awkward there.
Got it. So it sounds like there's some pretty good information, or at least, you know, end states coming out of having civilian advisors there, working with military counterparts. And it sounds like, you know, you were able to get some stuff done and learn a lot about this whole programming being on the advisory panel. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, my time, you know, all of it mattered equally. My time in uniform mattered just as equal as my time going back to coach. That mattered just as equally into my time now. But yes, you know, having the different lenses allows me to speak and understand folks. And that's why I say, like, the coaches that come on staff to all these different entities, I always try to make myself available to them, especially those that aren't simply from the culture, to understand what they're dealing with and who they're dealing with. Because they've heard, you know, terms like tactical athlete and, you know, different ideas, and they may have their own opinion of what they're walking into. That could be completely wrong.
Yeah, it sounds, you brought a lot of stuff to bear during that time. I mean, obviously your time in the Marine Corps, drill instructor, all have had hands on a physical component. What was it like transitioning, obviously, from, you did civilian work, did some advisory stuff, but transitioning now to Beaver Fit USA, how did that transition work? How did that introduction work?
Yeah, you know, they were, Beaver Fit USA was the main supporter of one of the big competitions on Quantico, where we brought the top 50 athletes of the Marine Corps together to have them compete for a week. And their equipment was on deck, you know, so we coexisted and worked together. And about a month after that, you know, they had gave me a ring and just said, hey, you know, if you're ever interested in coming out here, love to conversate with you. And that's where it started. And, you know, I respected the start because it came from the very top of the company and from the ownership of the company. And it was very empathetic in nature to understand, like, hey, I know you have a great role that you love. And it was also very vulnerable over them truly, you know, letting me know that, yes, I would love to have you here. So it wasn't kind of cat and mouse or hidden. And, you know, it was very full frontal disclosure. And of course, you know, when I worked with them, they caught my eye with a t-shirt they had. On the back of one of the t-shirts, it says, "We create what doesn't exist yet." And even to this day, you know, I still feel I live so much in that realm of just constantly looking at creating possibly what does not exist yet, whether it's people or equipment or processes.
Wow, that's a cool catchphrase for sure. You know, there's a lot to be left to the imagination of what can be done, what they can do. So what have you found, you know, working for Beaver Fit Plus beforehand? What's their overall mission? What did you kind of find out about them?
Yeah, so, you know, obviously coming to them, when I came to them, Beaver Fit was, you know, a provider of outdoor fitness equipment when I got there, right? Like they were known for their performance lockers, which if people aren't tracking, that's basically taking a Connex box that we ship goods often through the railways or on ships and, you know, really just completely outfitting them on the inside for storage, on the outside for lifting stations. And they were known at the time for a little bit of obstacle course work here and there, you know, and the whole point being, though, was it wasn't that they were settled on that was who they were. They were, that was what they were doing. But they were settled on constantly looking at how we could equip the warfighter and how we could equip, you know, the service member to just win at what they need to do. And if you flash forward that, you know, four and some change later now, where, you know, we do a lot of indoor facilities, a lot of outdoor performance centers, you know, a lot of apartment amenities, fitness franchises, you know, your metabolics and your rumble boxings, that type of the world. And then even still to this day, back to its core of we create what doesn't exist yet, was that, you know, we're still, you know, creating floating VBS trainers for Coast Guard personnel to train on how to board a ship out of Connex containers, or creating rappel towers or shoot houses. So what drew me to it was simply the will to not settle and the will to truly care about what you do. And that was what they always showcased me from the very beginning.
Wow, that's great, man. I mean, you learned a lot about them, and they obviously had some really good traits to offer. So, which sound like are in line with, you know, your personal goals just from talking with you here. My first time seeing those guys was one of the Connex Box gyms at a law enforcement training facility set up for a SWAT competition. And I'd seen that. I was like, this thing's interesting. It's on the side of this, like, it looks like a 20-foot Connex box, all kinds of attachments on the outside. So from your knowledge, those products, were those built to be kind of packaged up and then deployed overseas, sent all over the place, or was it just for a small footprint at a location?
Yeah, so the original intent of it was for them to be deployable so they can all break down, everything can go inside. You know, they even went to the extreme length of getting what you would call a NATO airport certification so that they can go on a bird, they can go on a vessel, you know, whatever the case may be. But that certification means that when you get there and you open the doors, everything looks exactly the same. That's really what it means. And so, yes, it was all training and nature in the beginning to just be this idea of pack it up, go wherever it goes, wherever you go.
Wow, man, that would have been great to have in Iraq, man. We were, I'm sure you'd seen some of this as well, using like 5-gallon jugs and sand in MRE boxes for all kinds of different implements to lift. That would have been nice to have that. I mean, we didn't even have TRX at the time. I don't think there was anything that was off-the-shelf commercial available to us. But man, this sounds very easy to get out to a forward deployable place.
Yeah, absolutely. Really is.
Yeah. Well, good, man. So that's kind of like their mission, what they've been doing in the past, what they're currently doing. What was their background? Like, who is BeaverFit to be even in this space at all? What did they start out doing?
Yeah. You know, it's super interesting story that actually starts with crossing the pond into the UK. And because everybody, of course, when they hear BeaverFit, they're like, where in the world, you know, what is BeaverFit? And Beaver is actually the last name. Tom Beaver in London, or excuse me, in the UK, is actually who started the company out, and started out by literally welding a rack on the side of a container during the Olympics for those that were having to support the Olympics in London to train on. And hey, test this out. Let me know what you think. That was the birth of the idea. The Beaver family was known for bridge building in England. That moved to North America ownership, which is Mike Taylor and Alex Rudehouse, who realized, you know, both of them being Navy Riverine veterans, over like, man, that stuff would really have worked well for us in Iraq. Hey, that would really work well for us everywhere we go. And they brought it into North America. And so even to this day, Tom Beaver and his father, Jim, and Mike Taylor and Alex Rudehouse, that is still the head of the entire worldwide entity of BeaverFit, as it is still the same folks who dreamed it up and laid it out there and put it in play are still the same exact four to this day.
Wow, that's really cool, man. What a great story. So they somehow got connected with Tom and kind of spun the idea of like, hey, in the US, this could really take off. And that's kind of where that was birthed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it really came through, you brought it up, TRX. They both were working for TRX in their time. And we're working as kind of a reseller of that idea. And then it just went into TRX wanted to go a different direction. So instead of saying, hey, we'll let it die, they decided to say, no, let's go all in on this idea. And left TRX, and the rest is history.
Man, what a great story, man. Just people like saying, hey, great idea. We want to serve a good mission and let's just get to work and let's get it done. I think it's great. Can you talk a little bit now? What are you doing now with BeaverFit? What is your role and what's your kind of like, you know, mission personally for the company?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I am the director/program manager of training and education for us. And, you know, obviously when most people hear those terms, they go to the workout, right? Like, oh, you know, they teach people to work out, and it's actually not that. So for us, what we look at with our training and education model is how do we create processes and systems that allow the gear to be successful? And how do we eliminate the burden of creation that this model of strength and conditioning often levies against the small unit leader? So instead of the idea of, hey, we need the small unit leader to be able to figure out the workout, then we need to be able to figure out, hey, how do you get a squad through this gear? How do you get a platoon through this gear? How do you get a company through this gear? That's where I come in and our side comes in. And what we've written is the systems and the processes. And then we go on site and we spend time with them to implement them. And the way that I use it in an analogy is that what I want folks to think about the gear is that, hey, if a plane is sitting at the gate, there is a pilot that has to get on the plane and hit a pre-flight checklist. Then he boards everybody, and there's this amount of time where everybody is now involved from takeoff to landing. And then when we get to the gate, there's another set of processes once everybody's gone so that it's done and ready for the next group that may ever come to use it. And the reason that it works, especially in the military customer, is because the military is built on processes. Usually with me being on site in the first 2 minutes in the Marine Corps, and I can pretty much get away with anybody, but especially on Marine Corps units, it's like I always remind them, the very first thing you hear in the morning time when you were in boot camp was the very first thing you heard every day. And they all say, lights, lights, lights. Exactly. And then what did you hear next? You know, and they're like, well, get online. And I said, and then we stop right there. That's what our training and education team is. We want to put a process in place where people don't have to think about where do I put the kettlebell? Where do I put the barbell? How do I get a squad through? We want to eliminate all that. And that's what I do. I write that and think tank that along with my counterpart, Dr. Frankel, on as it constantly changes, as the products change, as the equipment changes, is to always have processes ready to go at the same time.
I mean, it sounds like such a valuable branch of what you're doing, because can you imagine a company dropping off this multi-million dollar gear at base X and going, hey, later, figure it out, have fun, get fit, and just walking off, right? Versus like, let's come in here, let's give you almost like an outline, a course outline on how to use this in 30 minutes, 45 minutes, an hour, you know? I mean, that's huge value right there, man. I mean, coming from, if I was an instructor for a squad or a platoon, I was like, how do I use this? You've got the Marine Corps background to go, hey, I know that you've got a said number of time to get this done and this done on the physical side. So that you've got to see huge value, or the people you're working with is going, man, thank you for coming. There's got to be some kind of, you know, communication there.
Yeah, you see the light bulbs go off. You know, I always reference at the same time that we know, you know, just based upon being alive for so long, that when a new subject or a new idea comes in and you're trying to learn it, that it takes somewhere around 7 or 8 times to kind of have that decent level of confidence in yourself. And, you know, our opening line is what we want to deliver is for the unit leaders to be confident and competent in their ability and not just search for completion. And I also don't need them to be leaders. I need them to be managers. And once they become confident and competent, that's where you'll see leadership take off. That's where you will see them dive into the new areas to create new things. And that's great. But in the beginning, all we simply need to do is to drive confidence and competence through repetition, through the systems, and they will discover when that transition of, okay, hey, I'm no longer just managing these sessions. I'm leading them now because I've got the system in place.
So do you guys have some kind of a certification program, or like maybe like a ground level instructor program that you're rolling out to, like, say, squad leaders or whoever?
So not certification. Yes, we have workshops. We have steered clear of the word certification, just because I think it's kind of gotten a little bit wonky over time. But yes, we have workshops that we come on site. We deliver them to, you know, as far as us being on ground and fully encompassed into them. And then from there, really, what I think is the valuable part is we maintain a personal touch point when it's over. So that, like, even this morning, I was on Lejeune last week. I was on the phone with that crew, just seeing how everything was going since last week, you know, and really, were they seeing kind of some of those, hey, let's go try it for the second time. Let's go try it for the first time. Let's just try. And that to me is everything, right? If we can see that, then what I also know is as they grow in that confidence and competence, their exploration of the entire physical domain that'll lead into other areas will begin. Because they are starting to find a battle rhythm with it. So to answer that question, no certification. However, yes, there is actual hard print, there is actual digital assets, and there is actual workshops involved with it.
That's great, man. It sounds like you guys are being very diligent on fostering relationships with, you know, the community you're serving versus just dropping off a product and letting them figure it out. I think that's huge, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do, you know, I would tell you from my heart, you know, every once in a while this comes up is, you know, my loyalty is always to the end users winning, right? And those end users in my world are often still the Marines, the soldiers, the airmen, the sailors. I want them to win. And our company is no different, right? Like in our ethos, in our playbook is just win. And that doesn't mean for us to sell more gear. That means our folks have to be proficient in utilizing the gear for any of that to work. So it all boils down to, can our customers just win, and how can we help them do that?
Yeah, man. So it's a great ethos. I really respect what you guys are doing. As we kind of come to a close here, man, I brought up earlier with you is a lot of people that listen to our show out there training that we train on the tactical side are late 30s, early 40s, SWAT guys, patrol folks, military folks. What's your recommendation as far as how to look at fitness and what to kind of look for in a program when you start to becoming an older athlete, you know, for lack of a better term?
Yeah. You know, it's funny you say it, almost perfect timing, because I am that over 40 individual that's still trying to get after it. And, you know, and I pride myself in that. You know, I don't waste my time looking at other folks' aesthetics or accomplishments as much as I purely want to compete against myself every day. What I've realized over time is there was a time that I would definitely care about the visual pretty much, right? Like I want to look good, which still is, sure, it's there.
Yeah.
But I've realized over 40 is I want to feel good. And feeling good is a bit different now, right? Like last night was a prime example. I could feel the stiffness setting into my body. So, you know, it wasn't exactly what I wanted to do at the moment, but I went in here at my house, we have a full gym, and I went in the gym and I went in the sauna and just cranked it all the way up and spent about 30 minutes stretching. 15 years ago, you probably couldn't have paid me to stretch. And I could have cared less over that idea of stretching. What I tell folks as they progress is you must feel, and you need to respond to how you feel. And if you're are like, hey, I am feeling good, then go get after it, right? Go unleash yourself. That's fine. You know, I do not let age be the barrier of anything or the creator of anything. I want myself to always be that. But if you wake up like, ooh, that doesn't mean go kill it today. And that doesn't mean overlook that moment to those that still want to get after it, because the majority of them probably think and act much like myself. Yes, first off, you should warm up and you should find it that you're feeling as much as it means you need to respond to that as well. And, you know, so this is my advice. Find something that you enjoy to do to warm up. It does not have to be this incredibly long drawn out, you know, you need an 8-year degree to figure it out. Get your body temperature warmed up, move the body in a way that you're going to move in that session. And you probably already know your greatest weakness in an area, whether it's, you know, your hamstrings or your glutes, and spend some extra time in the warm-up on that little area. When I get to the workout portion, what I tell folks, again, go how you feel, but just be careful of the volume and be careful of what you're really trying to achieve out there. I don't really care personally to one rep max anything ever in my life again. It just doesn't have crossover. So I simply will not. And I am completely okay with that. If you want to search for that life, realize there's a risk, got it. And just realize that the road to recovery off injury from that is probably going to be a bit longer now. So control the volume, control the intensity, think about what you really want to do with your level of fitness. And then lastly, is what I say is where seriously look at recovery, because it is the foundation. It is not the end, the last thing you do. It's actually the first thing you need to do. And that, again, that is hypocritical as all hypocritical I can be for a majority of my life. I will tell you, I prioritize my sleep. I prioritize how much water I drink a day. I try to prioritize the amount of real food that I eat. And I prioritize as the evening's coming, I pretty much know how I'm going to feel the next day already. So just like last night, if I'm feeling it, take 20 or 30 minutes and stretch it out and work through some mobility, because those are two things. If you do not use it, you will 100% lose it over time.
Yeah, that's great info, man. I think people are going to really take some value out of that. So thank you for running through that. I'll take that to heart, man. I definitely, the warm up, the biggest thing I saw once I reached 40 and beyond was I had to warm up to perform the best that I could at that time. Yeah. You know? So I appreciate you doing that, man. So, well, what's on the horizon for you and BeaverFit, man? As this is, we'll kind of wrap up here, but what is the future look like for you guys?
Yeah, you know, as this landscape of human performance continues to develop itself, you know, more and more in the day-to-day life and operations of the U.S. service member, you know, for us, I think it's constantly staying on the cutting edge to compete with ourselves. And it is to constantly look at the spaces that we create via the customer need and ensure that those spaces are inclusive, not exclusive. And that we can really get to the fact of having our customer win. And what does that mean? It means that we realize like outdoors still matter. So our once performance locker that everybody knew, right now, as you and I speak, we have the newest version of all of those that we call Sun Pros being delivered that can provide, you know, really outdoor human performance areas that are covered, that have your rowers and your bikes and your lifting platforms and everything you would find inside of a facility right there at the unit level for them to get after it. So, you know, for us on the horizon, it's that it's to realize that it, much like you and I've talked about, the mission has remained the same, but the people have changed and the policies have changed and the way that we go about it has changed. And for us, it's constantly being willing to create new space and modify existing space so that we are in line with that. And, you know, that to me will always be who we are at the core is space providers and space creators alongside the customer that when we're done and we walk away, if it's this afternoon, tomorrow morning, they're ready to go and they can operate.
Yeah, it's a great journey you guys are on. And clearly BeaverFit's looking for quality people and stand behind what they're saying they want to do by putting out this kind of product and relationship building. So, man, I wish you guys all the best, man. It was great talking with you. Jason, good luck with everything, man. And take care. And I wish you nothing but success.
Yeah, Matt, I appreciate it. And, you know, from us to you, you know, thank you for the platform that just constantly allows the information to get out there to folks so that they really know what's truly available to them. And then they can make those choices over really what's best for them in their life or their units if they're still in there.